Well, the cosmic fireworks NASA created by blasting a hole in a comet were something for scientists and everybody else on this planet to cheer about this 4th of July weekend. The brighter than expected white flash of light climaxed a daring mission. That's something to be proud of on America's birthday, said Rick Remiere, the mission's project manager at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. About 12 hours after the barrel-sized Deep Impact space probe smashed into a comet half the size of Manhattan, scientists showed off dramatic, sci-fi-like images. They're up there on the coasttocoastam.com website. Photos shot by the impactor probe as it awaited its collision revealed for the very first time the surface of the comet Tempel 1 as it closed in at 23,000 miles an hour. The close-ups revealed not so much the pickle-shaped comet that scientists originally thought, but one that looked much like a potato, lumpy and pocketed. But what does it all mean? Throughout tonight, we're going to have several guests on the program right here on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates, physicist James McCanney, Richard C. Hoagland from the Enterprise mission, and Tom Van Flandern. They will be with us throughout the evening, in and out. And then the last hour, we will have Richard C. Hoagland with us and James McCanney as we take your phone calls. This email from Eric, who once at some point has now been reignited. He writes, "This has took a dying spark in me, and I've been reignited. I felt myself, George, shutting down, a part of me, gone. That part enjoyed science, space, biology. But I was able to truly enjoy NASA's Deep Impact project. Haven't felt this way since I was a kid, watching NOVA and being amazed at the vastness and the beauty of the universe. This was an exciting weekend, and in just a moment, it continues right here on Coast to Coast AM." Stephen Cates, Dr. Sky, an astronomical journalist and lecturer, has been involved in the science of astronomy for more than 30 years. Steve, Dr. Sky, as we call him, got his start in observational astronomy when he was 6 years old and living in the New York City area. During this period, he was a frequent visitor and student at the famous Hayden Planetarium. During the early years, Dr. Sky was trained as an actor and performer. He was a regular on many television commercials and radio ads during the 1960s, but his real passion has always been the wonders of the night sky. During high school and college, Steve, Dr. Sky, was involved with producing his own radio shows on astronomy and space science, and he was a regular on CNN during the early days of the network and wrote many astronomy columns for local newspapers. I'm going to chat with Dr. Sky this half hour about his views on this incredible situation that occurred as we smashed an impactor, Deep Impact, into Comet Tempel 1. Did you ever think we could do that, Stephen?
You know, George, it's amazing. I think it's always been science fiction to me, but it just blows the lid right off the whole thing. It's amazing talking to you about this just 24 hours and some change right after the event. So it's reality. It's amazing. Wow. That's all I can say.
Well, now, the scientists said that they were a little puzzled by what they were able to see. They had thought that comets were pickle-shaped, and now they say this one looked like a lumpy potato. What do they mean by that?
Well, actually, there's kind of a distinction here that I think we need to make, that a lot of folks who take a look at those first preliminary pictures, and wow, they're just super. These objects, the comets, if you just look at it with the untrained eye, they don't look any different than asteroids. They look like just what they should be, the remnants of creation about 4.5 billion years ago. And this is absolutely the best imagery we've ever had, at least now, to date, of an object we call the comet. Because in these photographs, we don't see the coma, that hazy area, the glowing material around this particular object. So to the untrained eye, or just everybody looking, it looks just like that of an asteroid. But there are differences, and I think we're going to be seeing, George, a lot of those differences in the next few days, what material might have come off the comet, the nucleus, and just how big that cratering impact is. That's yet undetermined at this point.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the history of comets. First of all, where do they come from, Steve?
Well, we believe, astronomers believe, that in the outer regions of the solar system, say 4.5 billion years ago when our solar system was thought to have evolved, and formed what we call today our planetary system.
Okay, so solar system, we're not necessarily talking about coming in from other regions of the universe now?
Well, we're actually talking about a big belt. There's a large, big cloud that we do know of, named in honor of a Danish astronomer. His name is Jan Oort. We call it the Oort Cloud, that lies extremely distant away from even the planet Pluto. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of astronomical units. So these are in between the stars,
all right,
for all practical purposes. And these objects, the comets, every so often, they look like these asteroids, but they have frozen surfaces on them because of the deep cold of space. The sun's gravity, or the gravity of other stars as they're moving through the universe, will tug on these objects. And lo and behold, we get not only Tempo 1, which has a known orbit, a periodic comet, but occasionally we'll get those great comets like we all remember back in 1997 with the super comet, Comet Hale-Bopp.
Now, what creates the tail effect?
What happens is, real simple, the sun, as the object moves closer to the gravity of the sun, this surface of the comet is laden with ice. And in physics, we have a term called sublimation. This is simple. When something goes from a state like, say, its frozen state, and goes directly and bypasses liquid, it goes directly to that of the gas. So what's happening is the surface of the comet, because of the sun's heat, is sublimating that material. And because of this large solar wind that we have, the sun's pumping out this energy, these tails are characteristically pointing away from the sun because of the stream of electrons and energy in the solar system. So we see this effect once this material is boiling off the surface as a tail pointed generally in the opposite direction from its motion.
How far away was Comet Tempel from planet Earth when this all occurred?
Allegedly, almost the exact distance is around 81 million miles as the crow would fly in space. But this is interesting because this comet is not the most difficult or distant object. As I mentioned before, it's a predictable comet. It's known as officially 9P. The 9P stands for the ninth periodic comet that was ever discovered. So it's an object that's a comet that actually lies between the orbits of Mars and the orbits of Jupiter. And Jupiter has a lot, George, to do with the orbit itself, because over time, Jupiter, with its great gravity, warps that comet's orbit, and not enough that it would be in any way harm to the Earth, at least that we think of. So they picked this comet because of its nearness, the ability to get to an object in such a short time, and for other reasons that, they go on, but one of the most prolific is that the comet itself looks like an object that's gone around the sun for hundreds of millions of years in a predictable orbit. So it's a good target to take a look at. And lo and behold, science fiction becomes science reality.
Well, as you talked about, Stephen, Dr. Sky, the giant cloud of gas and dust that collapsed to create the solar system, Earth's solar system, about 4.5 billion years ago, and some of these comets then formed from the leftover building blocks of the solar system. Do we know how many comets are out there?
No, that's just as if we were to ask the question, how many stars are there in our Milky Way? We're having even a difficult time. The guesstimates are 200 billion stars in the Milky Way, but with comets, I would think that number is probably even higher, George, because this material, as you correctly stated, is left over from this creational ring, these material rings that gravitationally spun into planets. This large one is what's left over, and I would imagine that there's probably trillions of these objects out. I don't think it's just endemic to our sun, our star, the sun. I think this happens throughout the universe. I think a lot of other astronomers would agree that depending on a sun-like star, or even stars that are a little hotter than us, we may see these big rings of comets. And one of the greatest theories is that obviously life here on Earth may have come from this theory called panspermia, where the cometary nuclei may have flecked off material like dandruff. The DNA of life, as we know it, from these comets, They may become starry messengers to seed life all throughout the universe.
Well, they very well may be, and it's very exciting just to see what they did today. If you could equate this, was this like hitting a needle in a haystack, or was it a little more accurate than that?
Well, I think it's something like that, what you described, but I'd look at it in terms of firearms. Let's say we're talking about a marksman trying to shoot a target, and for those of the folks out there that may not understand this, if they're using iron sights instead of using a scope, that's like a rifleman or a marksman shooting at the farthest distances, like 2,000, 3,000 yards away, and expecting to put it in the bullseye. We sure the heck did a great job on this. From 500,000 miles, we hit an area on the targeting map of about 3.5 miles, which is totally, absolutely astounding.
What are the possibilities that comets out there somewhere, Dr. Sky, could collide with planet Earth?
I think that's a probable thing. I don't think there's anything, at least that we're being told right now, of any comet that's coming right down the pike. I think the asteroids, George, as you've talked about on this show and many other fine guests that you have, The near-Earth asteroid objects, I think, are of more concern than a direct comet, but if it were a comet, good God and help us all, because obviously the size of these objects, for the most part, is fairly large. This one's maybe a 6-kilometer-in-length object, but some of these comets, like Hale-Bopp, may be upwards of 20 miles or 25 miles across. The comets would be the worst because of their super high velocity and trajectory. And that brings up a good point that all the Coast listeners, we would like to invite them to visit drsky.com for a complete update, George, not only in the multimedia sense of things we've actually produced ourselves, but the interesting point is, and a lot of people, George, are asking this question, how the heck do you find the comet in the sky? And we've, I think, done a very good job to give all the Coast listeners an opportunity, when at their convenience, of course, to check in with us and kind of scan that information, because finding this object, this was the most difficult comet that we've ever looked at least from my standpoint. With sophisticated telescopes and good friends, I must report honestly always that we actually did not find the comet here in the suburbs of the Phoenix metro area, all because of light pollution and the faintness of the comet.
So if you were way out somewhere, you might have been able to spot it.
We might, and there are reports coming in all over the Internet about people who had those dark skies with telescopes twice as large as the 8-inch telescope that we used, which is a good size to find this object, and they themselves claim that they had a difficult time or failed in the pursuit of seeing it. So if people still want to know how to find the comet, I think it's a good opportunity for those out there that have that right equipment to go outside, or excuse me, to go to drsky.com and check that website out. Because that's not only done in the video sense, we've also put together a whole way of helping people to understand how do you find many of the objects that you talk about here on Coast to Coast AM.
Stephen, what's the big difference then between asteroids and comets?
Well, the asteroids themselves are actually objects that do not have this frozen surface like we believe comets do. We believe that the asteroids are probably, and this is just very general, made from a planetary collision that occurred somewhere a long time ago, of course, for an object that was lying in between that of Mars and Jupiter. But the comets, George, are even more complex because they contain that original soup, that primordial soup. The difference, very simply, is the constitution of these comets, as I think we're going to see with Tempel 1, is greatly different material-wise than that of what asteroids are. They were the original formulative objects, that is, here in the solar system. They contain something very special, and that is, and more than likely, some sort of amino acids or life as we may know it from the earliest days, and the quest continues to search for these objects. It's just so fascinating to be able to be alive today, the understatement of the century, I think, to be able to see all these things happening right before our eyes. And I kind of characterize this as the multimedia comet, because for the most part, I think many of your listeners would agree, and your guests for the rest of the morning, this is probably one of the most difficult objects to see looking in the sky, but the real fun of it was just by sitting in front of your television and watching it unfold. And hopefully in the future, by doing programs like this, we'll be able to all learn how to find these objects. Because yes, George, one of those objects will, of course, we know it, sad to say, come straying out from space from the deep dark recesses of the solar system and one day come toward the Earth. And we're learning a lot about how to possibly deflect comets, even from this very basic experiment of slamming in this 820-pound impactor. This will be, of course, the subject of maybe a future defense shield for the Earth someday.
Well, you know, Steve, my contention is that this was not just an experiment to try to determine the origin of life on this planet and whether whether these comets seeded us or not. I really think the purpose was, and I don't think they wanted to create panic. What's your take that they did this as a test to see if we could hit an incoming object and see how accurate we could get?
I think you're absolutely right, and my take on it is exactly that. Right down the highway, where we didn't know exactly what the chemical constitution of the comet was all about, we still never had radar imaging or photographs of the surface of this object. So yes, exactly. I believe that in the future, this is to see exactly how we can target an object. We've done it successfully, and I think, of course, not to sound totally alarmist, but there are those rogue near-Earth asteroids that one day they may be the intended target. So we applaud the scientists, not only of NASA, but all around the world, for being able to target an object. And I think we're also going to learn some great science as this unfolds right before our eyes.
There are some that are saying, why are we spending hundreds of millions of dollars to simply smash a comet, knock some rocks off into the universe, into space? Why are we doing this? Well, I guess that perspective then, Steve, would change if we all understood that this could very well have been a test to hit or deflect anything incoming to protect and save this planet.
Absolutely, George. You're right on again. And I believe that this is a very basic test. This is like the Wilbur and Orville Wrights flying that 120 feet or so just to get off the ground. And I believe very strongly that we're going to see much more of this technology focused on not only that, but also, again, back to the science side of it, to learn about what the whole soup is out there on these comets, that frozen primordial soup, the creation of the universe, the creation of life, where it all came from. But just outstanding stuff, like 24 hours after it. My eyes are sore from looking for this comet, but, you know, that's what we do, right? And we love it.
For a moment, I was going to say that you were with Galileo when he invented his telescope, but I didn't want to do that, Steve. You're not that old, huh?
Not yet, but it's just been an outstanding weekend. And, you know, George, I want to thank you very much for having me here. And, of course, as the listeners know, a regular writer and contributor to After Dark, I wrote extensively about this mission last month, June 2005, After Dark, to give everybody a heads up on this. And I appreciate your participation with some of the future events like we were talking about here and one of the Coast affiliates, KVNA and Flagstaff, to get the word out about all the wonderful things that we can see in our nighttime sky and how to work together to learn more about this most amazing subject.
I am just amazed at how they were able to spot this thing and, as you said, 83 million miles away, just, you know, get this mission going and then get in there and blow a piece of it up. And it's just, the whole thing is just incredible.
No, it's incredible indeed. And, you know, we have some interviews on our Dr. Sky website, too, that I think people would appreciate. I was privileged and honored to be able to speak with Dr. Lucy McFadden, one of the science investigators there. And people, of course, can go there at their leisure to listen and learn all about the deep science behind Deep Impact. And I'm amazed at this closing comment here. I understand that 10,000 people were camped out in Hawaii's Waikiki Beach to watch this, George. I'm not surprised, on a giant movie screen. That's incredible. And I just reminded myself that I was one of the 625,000 people, and you know who you are out there, that sent their names onto the CD-ROM that went and was obliterated on the surface of Temple One yesterday. So that was kind of a fun little thing, and lots of kids got involved in that project. So our names went to space, and, well, I guess they're now dust.
Can you imagine 50 years ago if anybody were to be told, if you went back into time and said, we're going to have this device that we're going to launch into space called Deep Impact, and we're going to blow up a part of a comet. You know, they would have looked at you 50 years ago, Steve, and hauled you off somewhere.
Absolutely, and look at it now. It's just 24 hours and some change fresh, and we're still getting the information. It's just amazing. And, you know, I'm just thankful that we're able to participate in shows like this and able to discuss these wonderful things because, like they used to say, you ain't seen nothing yet. I think there's going to be a lot more in the way of studying this. We're going to be sending a mission probe in the next year or two to the planet Pluto. We're going to be talking about also scooping up samples from comets and bringing the material back here to planet number three, the Earth. And next year, we get, hopefully, some of the Stardust mission results from Comet Vilt 2, which will be brought back to Utah. And this time, hopefully not a comedy of errors, when the material comes from space, maybe this time we'll be able to catch it and see exactly what those little tiny grains of life are inside cometary surface dust.
Well, let's hope that by blasting away parts of this comet, we haven't created a problem for us and that none of this material will come our way, huh?
I'm hoping not, and I think at 80-some-odd million miles, we're kind of safe at this point in time, but it's always fun to watch. And again, if people go to the website, you'll be able to learn how to find this comet. And again, George, difficult to see. The truth is always what sets us free, but still, for people out there who have the right equipment, you can still follow it, because the comet, I'm sure, it did brighten, by the way. Visually, the comet shot up in magnitude for those lucky enough to see
it. It's kind of still sizzling a little bit out there, isn't it?
It sure is.
All right, Stephen, thanks so much, my friend.
Thank you, George.
You take care. DrSky.com. That's linked up with coasttocoastam.com. In a moment, our guest will be physicist James McCanney. He is an expert on comets. We'll get his take on all of this in a moment. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, Richard C. Hoagland and astronomer Tom Van Flandern will be our guest. In a moment, though, physicist James McCanney right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, he's got a Master of Science degree. He's a physicist, Professor James McCann. He has spent decades promoting his theoretical work showing that the solar system is ever-changing and is electrically active. These theories have been confirmed with space probe data and prove that there are definite Earth effects resulting from our sun's electrical activity. McCann was a faculty member of the Physics and Mathematics Department of Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, and he has researched theoretical celestial mechanics and plasma physics, studies of planetary motion and electrified gases in outer space, and has presented his theories at the Los Alamos National Laboratories and the American Geophysical Union. I flew, by the way, right over, sort of right over, Los Alamos just yesterday, Jim.
And, did you see anything going on there?
Is something strange? No, I tried to look between the clouds, but I could not. Hey, this successful attempt to blast away at a comet really must have been a thrill for you.
I was very excited, and the one thing I always say is I have the highest praise for the engineers that work in these aerospace companies that build this stuff, and that, you know, the guidance and the you know, these are the unsung heroes, and I want to give them a little shot in the arm here to let them know that, you know, because we always hear the scientists and the people in the news, but the real guys that make it happen, their shirts, sleeves rolled up, and their, you know, pocket protector in their pocket, and those are the guys that really make a lot of this happen. So
let's talk a little bit about the data, Jim, the data that they've got now, the data that they will still get and interpret. What do you think will be some of the most significant things coming out of this mission?
Well, first of all, like you say, a lot of the data is not in yet. So, you know, it's early to make a lot of calls. I'm anxious to look at, for example, say, Chandra X-ray data to see if anything sparked some X-rays out of this event. But the main thing that I've seen so far is, as with the other comets that we visited, there is no visible ice or snow or water on the comet nucleus itself. And of course, we see a lot of those chemicals in the tail. But what we're seeing here now, when we see these images of this asteroid moon-like surface, to provide the amount of water that we see in the tail rushing around this comet nucleus, if it were blowing away in the solar wind, as they say with the dirty snowball comet model, you would have to have the equivalent of a steam engine producing that much and venting that much water coming out of this nucleus, and we don't see that. So that's a very big indicator right there that there is no snow or ice in the nucleus. Also, there was no immediate data from the spectrometer, the infrared spectrometer, suggesting that the explosion created water or ice in that explosion. There was a lot of dust, of course.
As you had thought, I believe, right?
Exactly, exactly. And it's difficult for people schooled in the traditional theories to make this leap to understand that the water is not coming out of the nucleus and how this works. And I've got an entire paper just on small comets because it's very complicated how they can draw in material, and then this also then leaves and gives the illusion of material coming from a nucleus. But when you look right at the nucleus, nose to nose, like we are right here, there is no water or ice or snow on the nucleus.
Now, Jim, for people all around this planet who are trying to make a living, they're working, you know, they're doing whatever they can. You talk about comet tails, some of these people busting their tails to just get by now every once in a while. What's the significance of all of this for me, for them?
Well, like you were talking about earlier, we really have to understand these because we know in the past that Earth has been devastated by objects like these, whether they crashed into the Earth or, as I have talked about, where larger objects have come by, you have action at a distance, gravitational waves or electrical effects, and that the whether you whichever you know catastrophe you look at, these things can affect Earth in a very bad way, and we have to learn about these. My own personal opinion, and of course, I'm somewhat critical of NASA at times. But I think that they should have a lot more money, a lot more funding, and a lot more activity like this, because this is the bottom line. If we don't learn how to control our environment and space, that's the big one.
Well, this was a Manhattan-sized comet.
Right.
If this thing happened to have been coming right for the planet, do we have anything available right now that could have obliterated this thing?
No,
and I'm not talking
really.
About take a little chunk away. I mean, just smash it to smithereens if it was coming right at the planet.
Well, the problem is with any explosion, you have to get the explosive down inside to affect it, to break it into pieces. And then if you do that, you have the extra problem of having many pieces. So there's a lot of people that believe we should not be blowing these things apart, but we should be moving them into other orbits.
Like deflecting them somehow.
Somehow. And there again, if my theory for comets is correct, we can actually go out and extend the electrical discharge with a cable, basically like a carbon cable coming out the back end, a tether, so to speak, increasing the discharge, and actually, with the comet tail drag, maneuver these comets with a very simple mechanism like that. Deflect them into other orbits. And of course, the key to all of this is knowing which one is the problem asteroid or comet long in advance so that we can do this slight maneuver, because a slight tug or push now has a great effect in a year or two.
Now explain how this would work. I mean, how do you get this? You zoom this huge carbon fiber out there to try to attach itself to a comet? What do
you
do?
Well, yeah, and you let it out, and we've already done projects like this with the shuttle, for example, and we had a great electrical discharge come down that tether and almost dismantled one of the shuttles. But what happens is then you extend the electrical discharge, create a larger comet tail. The comet tail material drags on the nucleus and therefore slows it down or changes its orbit. And so if you could do this a couple years in advance of when this thing should hit Earth, then you could change its orbit enough so it would miss, and hopefully it would not come back for a long time.
What's the difference here in terms of significance with a comet that could be a dirty snowball, with a comet that could be all rock, with a comet that could be all, you know, some kind of iron, for example? What's really the significance here, Jim?
Well, if one of them comes in and hits us directly, it would make little difference at that point. But the idea is to find out how to maneuver these. And, of course, that's what this was all about, as you were talking about earlier, just the fact that engineers can design and guide a probe that accurately and then get those last-minute mid-course corrections so that this hits exactly where they want it. That's huge. That is very important, because previously they just flew by. But now to actually extend another probe and watch it with the first one, something I've been saying all along is that a lot of the NASA design programs have been, I wouldn't say improperly designed, I would do it very differently, but we have to have multiple spacecraft out there watching each other to observe electrical effects. Or one of the things I was looking for here, and I have a picture right in front of me, as the probe left the mother spacecraft, and was flying away, they took some pictures of it. And one thing I thought is that probe itself could discharge the local capacitor and form a small tail. And the picture isn't clear enough that I have to show if that's what's really going on. But it does appear that the probe itself was discharging the local capacitor and forming a little tail, a little plasma tail around it. But bottom line is, all of this experimentation is essentially essential to our survival on this planet in the future. And I wish we had a lot more of this 30 years ago.
Well, unfortunately, I guess we didn't have the technology to do this, did we?
Well, it's hard to say because look at the Voyager spacecraft. They were very accurate in getting out to the outer planets, for example, in getting by a very precise location. So we probably did, but didn't know it, I would put it that way. But this is a huge first step. And I suspect we're going to see a lot more of this type of accurate pinpoint maneuvering in the future.
Jim, this particular mission, do you think it really was geared primarily to try to figure out how life started, at least on this planet? Or do you think the mission primarily was to see if they could land, deflect, hit an incoming object? Stevens, Cates, Dr. Skye, before you came on, agrees with me that possibly the mission was to see if we could hit an object.
Oh, absolutely. And there's a whole list. I have a list next to me here of all of the space probes coming up, the Japanese, the Europeans. All are trying to pursue this where they actually land or contact an object. We've flown by asteroids and moons and orbited moons and or asteroids, but now that the next goal is to contact, drill into, and early on it was realized that these objects don't have enough gravity to put a drilling device down and have it stay. So somehow you have to drill in and hold it, and since you don't know what the surface composition is like, that's a very difficult thing to design unless you can put a big rope around it, you know.
Now, this is a Manhattan-sized comet. To me, that sounds pretty big. How would you categorize this in terms of size with things that we know might be out there?
Well, there's a size distribution, and it's something that astronomers know about, that there, if you take dust grains, there's, you know, uncountable number of dust grains. As you get up to something this size, there might be, in the solar system, 20,000 of them. That's just off the top of my head. It's not a real number out of a book. But as you get up to moon-sized objects, there's only 40 of them. And as you get up to planet-sized objects, there's only 9. And as you get up to the sun-sized size of objects, there's only 1 in our solar system. So it gives you a size distribution. And as you get to smaller and smaller objects, there's more and more of them.
Jim, there are some people out there on the Internet who say that Jim McCanney claims that all comets become planets. You want to talk about that for a moment?
Oh, yeah, thank you, because that's one of the great misnomers of my work. And what I talk about is plasma physics. Any object, in fact, like this probe itself, as I was saying, could discharge the local capacitor and act like a comet. And certainly that's not going to become a planet. So any object can discharge a local plasma capacitor, and you get the comet effect with the electron beam coming from the negative side, the primary charge carrier, and then the influx to the charged nucleus, the negatively charged nucleus, of the positively charged material. So becoming a planet is a very rare and unique situation where an object that's very large is captured into the solar system, into the plane of the planets, in a prograde direction, and then works its way into the solar system to become a planet without colliding with something else. It's a very complicated, I have chapters in my early papers on the statistics of solar system formation, where I do talk about the size of objects, the size distribution. So not every comet becomes a planet by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, it's a very rare event. But when the big comets come in, they are gathering this material, and they change their orbits very rapidly because they have enough gravitational attraction to hold this material. We don't see these big comets very often. There's historical records of people seeing them. Hale-Bopp was a pretty small comet compared to the big comets of history. So once again, the size distribution, we have not seen the big comets in the solar system, and that's why astronomers claim they don't exist. But in historical records, and you look at the effects of these objects which have come by Earth on occasion, you see the geological record very clearly that these objects have come through the solar system. You see the markings on other planets and moons.
What would Velikovsky have said about this most recent mission?
Well, of course, he claimed that there was electrical activity in the solar system. And, you know, in his day, much of this was unknown. In fact, when Velikovsky was around, they didn't even know that there were that there was a nucleus with the comet. There were theories that maybe they were just loosely composite groupings of dust and sand. For example, they didn't even see the first cometary nucleus until, I can't remember the year, but probably after Velikovsky was around, where they actually confirmed and actually saw a comet nucleus. But he would have probably been looking for electrical effects, that type of thing.
Okay, so what if they find out that there seems to be a lot of evidence for electrical discharges confirming plasma discharges from comets? What does that mean?
Well, for example, the unexplained flash. Now, with all of our knowledge of the copper disk and the probe and, you know, all the advanced studies that were done, still there was a surprise that as this probe approached, that there was a gigantic flash. And I would like to see, for example, like I mentioned earlier, the Chandra or the Newton X-ray telescope, to see if there was any evidence of X-ray activity, something that I'm very close to. I just got back a short while ago from the American Geophysical Union meeting in New Orleans, where I gave a presentation on X-rays in the solar system, and specifically with comets. So this is something I'm very near and dear to. That was something I predicted in my earliest papers when nobody was even dreaming that comets could have X-rays.
What do you think some of the biggest pieces might be in terms of size from this impact out there floating around now?
Oh, I think it's dust or powder at best. I don't think many large chunks came out of this.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, that's a good thing. And, of course, once before I was on your show and the last caller asked, oh, could this, you know, something fly free and damage Earth? And it's just very far away. The majority of this debris, you could already see it dissipating in the solar wind as it came out and started to move away. So, yeah, this is not something that would be detrimental to Earth.
I guess what made this so successful, I guess, to those of us here back on planet Earth was that because of the video, because the ability to see this just made it just seem so lifelike, didn't it?
Oh, that is amazing. And when I watched I watched it over and over again looking for various conditions. And, of course, like everybody, was amazed at the flash that occurred there.
It was very bright.
Oh, very bright. And then it moved out, and you could see the shadow up along the nucleus as the material moved out and into the sunlight and shadowed that region of the nucleus. So it'll be interesting to see as the mother spacecraft, releases its data, what it actually saw.
Well, this mission was launched on January 12th. The spacecraft traveled 268 million miles to get to the comet, get it in its sights, and just was a dramatic success. And as we both talked about, Jim, the data will continue to come forward. And I think they're going to find some pretty startling things, don't you?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. The one thing I wish in the future is that, and I'd always, of course, every scientist wishes this, but I wish that I could have a little more input into the design of these spacecraft because, for example, to test the plasma conditions, to measure the electron beam from the side that they're not expecting it, those type of things, that we see these things in the data by mistake a lot of times.
They didn't even ask you this time?
No, although I do know some of these scientists that are on these teams, well, but no, I'm not on the list of inquiry there.
At least not yet. You're going to be back in an hour to take phone calls with Richard C. Hoagland, okay?
Yes.
James McCanny. He'll be back in a moment. Next hour, Richard C. Hoagland from the Enterprise mission and astronomer Tom Van Flandern, our guest, as we talk more about deep impact right here on Coast to Coast AM.